It's Wednesday, April 15th. I'm Jane Costin, and this is What A Day, the show that has more questions for President Donald Trump about his fascinating theory regarding diet soda. I learned about this theory from the head of Medicare and Medicaid, Dr. Mehmet Oz, here speaking on Donald Trump Jr.'s podcast, Triggered.
Your dad argues that diet soda is good for him because it kills grass. It's poured on grass, so therefore it must kill cancer cells inside the body. So he'll try to, please.
Question. Does diet soda kill grass? And if it did, wouldn't that imply that diet soda is very, very bad for you? On today's show, a new report says the global economic outlook is not looking great. And President Trump responds to a federal emergency management agency official who claims that he teleported to a Waffle House. No surprise, he says he doesn't know anything about it or the official. But let's start with Congress and its ongoing epidemic of sexual misconduct. Two members of Congress stepped down on Tuesday. Texas Republican Representative Tony Gonzalez and California Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell. Here is a clerk of the House of Representatives reading their resignation statements.
Enclosed is my resignation letter to Texas Governor Greg Abbott, effective April 14, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It has been my privilege to serve the residents of Texas's 23rd Congressional District. Signed sincerely, Tony Gonzalez, Member of Congress. I plan to resign my seat in Congress effective at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on April 14, 2026. I will work with my staff in the coming days to ensure they are able, in my absence, to serve the needs of the good people of the 14th Congressional District. Signed sincerely, Eric Swalwell.
Gonzalez and Swalwell differ in almost every single way. Gonzalez was endorsed for re-election by Trump. Swalwell was one of the loudest voices opposing Trump. Gonzalez dropped out of his re-election campaign weeks ago, while Swalwell was one of the top candidates in the California gubernatorial primary until this past weekend. But they share one horrible commonality. Both men have been accused of sexual misconduct. Gonzalez and Swalwell were accused of sexual misconduct by former staffers. Swalwell is also accused of sexual assault, and other women have come forward. He has denied the allegations. I've been writing about politics for more than a decade now, and that means I've been covering sexual misconduct in politics for more than a decade. Sexual assault by politicians seems almost endemic to me. Over and over, we see powerful people in politics, typically men, use their power to take advantage of others in dangerous and abusive ways. And, as we know, it goes all the way to the top. The President of the United States himself was found liable for sexual abuse in 2023. So, why does this keep happening? And what about Congress might be making it more difficult for survivors to come forward? To find out, I spoke to Moira Donegan. She's a columnist covering gender and politics at The Guardian. Moira, welcome to What A Day.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
We are almost 10 years removed from Me Too. And up until now, it's felt like not much permanently changed. We've seen kind of a backlash and then a backlash to the backlash. It's been weird. But this week, we saw two representatives, Tony Gonzalez of Texas and Eric Swalwell of California, resign over allegations of sexual misconduct and harassment that have been circling for weeks. What do you think changed?
You know, I think there is a sense that Me Too is a reflection of exasperation, right? These like sort of politicized moments of sexual violence return when people are outraged by impunity, right? And there's been a lot of sort of simmering attention to the issue of sexual violence, particularly among elites, in the wake of the Epstein scandal. And as people, you know, confront both the extent of complicity in Epstein's alleged crimes and the sort of pervasive impunity, I think there has been sort of a wearing down of patience. And what you saw when these allegations about Swalwell came out, really just over the past few days, is a sort of confrontation with the reality of the pervasiveness of this issue and a lack of patience. And I think this is interesting that it redounded also to Tony Gonzalez, whose alleged misconduct has been public in the popular media for much longer, but who had managed to hold on to his seat in Congress until just this week.
Swalwell and Gonzalez are not the only politicians in Congress with allegations against them. Speaker Mike Johnson said Tuesday that he will be, quote, looking into the House investigation of Republican Representative Corey Mills, who has been accused of sexual misconduct, a bunch of other things. But here's my question for you. What do you think it says that serious accusations of sexual misconduct are treated like tit-for-tat political fodder? Like, well, you get rid of one of yours, we might get rid of one of ours.
Yeah, you know, it's very conspicuous that Swalwell's resignation seems to have been what prompted the Republicans to finally cut Tony Gonzalez loose. You know, and I think there is something a bit dispiriting about this kind of mutual weaponization of sexual abuse by each side of the political rivalry, right? It seems as if it's less opposed to on principle than deployed as a tool against one's political enemies in a kind of cynical or even opportunistic manner. And I think what the challenge will be for feminists and for those of us who are, you know, committed to a principled opposition to rape and violence, will be to try and make this into a principle that can be applied even when it's not particularly politically convenient, or that will be applied, that people tend to apply both to their own side and to their opponents.
Waterday spoke with two Democratic House aides, one current and one former, about the allegations against Swalwell and Gonzalez. And they indicated there could be more members accused of misconduct, which does not surprise me at all. You and I have been writing about and talking about this issue for a long time. I remember I wrote a piece about the Judgment Fund, which helps to fund sexual harassment lawsuits in Congress. That was in 2017. That was a story about former Michigan Representative John Conyers. That was, in political terms, that was 10,000 years ago. And this keeps happening. This is not new. If you go back to the 1970s, 1980s, Congress was in some ways worse and grosser. But what do you think it says about the culture of Congress and U.S. politics as a whole that this kind of toxic power dynamic is still so prevalent? Like, the stories from Swalwell's accusers sound so familiar, and that familiarity horrifies me, Moira. It genuinely horrifies me.
You know, Jade, I wish it was just the culture of Congress. I wish there was something perverse about this one institution uniquely that made these abuses happen there and nowhere else. But I think what really happens is that these kinds of abuses happen everywhere where there is unchecked power, everywhere where there are, men with a lot of people relying on them who have women who are proximate and vulnerable, right? I think this is something that, you know, we saw in Me Too, that this happens in the media, that it happens in Hollywood. We see that it happens in tech, that it happens in fast food. You know, this is a sort of broad culture-wide pathology of, you know, abuse of power, of eroticized domination, and of exploitation, largely of women by men. And, you know, I think that it is interesting that these abuses are so bipartisan, and that they are sort of pushing on fractures that are emerging within partisan coalitions, right? So the Swalwell allegations and his subsequent resignation have really disrupted the California governor's race, where there is an open bipartisan primary in which the two leading contenders will advance the general election in the fall. Swalwell looked to be, until, you know, just this weekend, as if he would be the front runner in that election. And now it's anybody's race. You know, Katie Porter has a much better chance. Tom Steyer has a much better chance. On the Republican side, you see the Epstein allegations roiling the MAGA coalition, not just because of Trump's populist and anti-elite messaging that is, you know, somewhat undermined by his connections to Jeffrey Epstein, but also because of a interestingly politicized right-wing grievance against sexual exploitation from the likes of Nancy Mace, who has been very vocal on this issue, and her attempt to add some, you know, public disclosure and transparency to these congressional funds for distributing sexual harassment settlements, that got shot down just last month in a really broadly bipartisan vote, right? So there's forces both in Congress and sort of across our culture that are both sort of pushing against this pervasive impunity for sexual violence and also sort of arraying to protect entrenched interests. It's not always who you would expect that is lining up on each side of this issue.
politics has the added element of people who are working within it believing, hoping, maybe, that they are contributing to something that will make the country better. Do you think that that contributes to that culture where it's not just a member of Congress, it's a member of Congress who maybe is working on an issue you care a lot about? And does that change how people think about these allegations or think about how this can happen when it's not just, oh, this person is super famous and super powerful? It's also, this person could make sure everyone gets health care or could ensure reproductive rights access in my state. They are also, apparently, a sexual predator.
Yeah, I think this is something that really influences both the way that broad audiences interpret these allegations and also the way that victims interpret their own set of responsibilities in either coming forward or in deciding not to report and disclose, right? You saw, you know, just very recently, the case of Dolores Huerta, the leader of the farm workers movement, who recounted her own rape by Cesar Chavez and said that she did not want to come forward at the time because she thought it would endanger the cause to which she had devoted her life, right? I think this is a pervasive feature of sexual abuse in sort of mission-oriented workplaces. And in the case of somebody like Eric Swalwell, I think this also impacts the way that, you know, party insiders and voters and those who are really invested in the Democratic Party or in the struggle against Trumpism are understanding this. You know, there really is something that we lose when somebody like Eric Swalwell, who was, for all his faults, you know, a talented anti-Trump surrogate on cable news, right? A very ambitious, public-facing, active guy who was useful in some ways to the anti-Trump political movement in the U.S. But I think it would be incomplete to talk about that loss without also considering the loss of these women who are degraded or humiliated or hurt or abused or otherwise not allowed to thrive in their own talents because of these kinds of abuses that they encounter in their fields.
Somehow at the same time, Harvey Weinstein is back in court this week. He's being retried for a rape case in New York City for the third time. So I have to ask, there have been a lot of criticisms of Me Too, and some of those I think have been pretty not helpful. The idea of it going too far, going after the wrong people, whatever. But it does say something to me that we're in a moment in which Harvey Weinstein, this is the third time people have been trying to get justice for what he allegedly did, and it's been nearly 10 years. What do you think that says about what Me Too could not get done?
Yeah, you know, Me Too was in many ways like sort of a speech movement, right? It was about making speakable realities and experiences that had been excluded from official reality, right? From the official public reckoning of what people did and what our histories contain. What they could not do was undo a millennia of patriarchal conditioning around sexual violence. What they could not do is rewrite these institutional habits that give a lot of deference to sexual abusers in particular and to wealthy sexual abusers especially. You know, what they could not do is erase the ability of the likes of Harvey Weinstein or, you know, Bill Cosby, whose conviction was also overturned, to purchase their way out of accountability, right? There's much broader structures of corruption, of institutional complicity, and of, you know, societal misogyny that have entrenched these outcomes. And to get rid of those, I think, is a much, much bigger project.
Moira, thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Thank you for having me, Jane. It was a pleasure.
That was my conversation with Moira Donegan, columnist for The Guardian. This is a show that thinks sexual misconduct is bad, no matter who's doing it. I know. Wild. If you agree, make sure you subscribe, leave a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, watch us on YouTube, and share the show with your friends. We'll be back after some ads. What A Day is brought to you by Delete Me. Delete Me makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. It's easier than ever to find personal information about people online. Having your address, phone number, and family members' names hanging out on the internet can have actual consequences in the real world and makes everyone vulnerable. More and more online partisans and nefarious actors will find this data and use it to target political rivals, civil servants, and even outspoken citizens posting their opinions online. With DeleteMe, you can protect your personal privacy or the privacy of your business from doxing attacks before sensitive information can be exploited. As someone with an active online presence, privacy is really important to me. It's not just about my internet usage, it's about keeping me and my family safe with DeleteMe. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/wad and use promo code WAD at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/wad and enter code WAD at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/wad, code WAD. WAD Today is brought to you by ZBiotics. Let's face it, after a night with drinks, I don't bounce back the next day like I used to. I have to make a choice. I can either have a great night or a great next day. That is, until I found pre-alcohol. ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Every time I have pre-alcohol before drinks, I notice a difference the next day. Even after a night out, I can confidently plan on running or working out without worry. From the fairways in Augusta to the first pitch of baseball season and the start of festival circuits, April is a sprint of outdoor celebrations. Don't let a rough next day keep you on the sidelines. Drink pre-alcohol to stay ahead of the game and make the most of every sunny Saturday. Go to zbiotics.com/wad to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use WAD at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/wad and use the code WAD at checkout for 15% off. Here is what else we're following today.
Headlines.
Joining me is Crooked's Washington correspondent, Matt Berg, to talk about the big stories. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Jane.
Matt, the world's economic outlook is looking grim, thanks to Trump's war in Iran. Here's Kevin Hassett, one of his top economic advisors, telling Americans on CNBC Tuesday that, hey, it could be worse.
While it's very frustrating to go to the pump and see what the price of gasoline looks like, that the benefit for oil producers and workers in those industries is significant enough that the GDP effect in the U.S. is much smaller than anything that you would see if you look at, say, an Asian economy or even in the U.K., where because of their, Green New Deal type policies, they've more or less stopped producing oil.
Two things. Is he saying, well, oil companies are doing well, so it's fine? Also, apparently it's bad to rely on green energy when the world is going through an oil crisis. We're learning new things all the time, Matt. But the bottom line is Donald Trump's war with Iran is hurting countries around the world. And yes, that includes the United States.
Right. The global economy could even slide into recession if the war continues, according to a report released by the International Monetary Fund on Tuesday. And the report also says that the global economic outlook was actually looking steady before Trump bombed Iran.
Which is wild, given the tariffs and everything else. Yet now, even the best case scenario looks grim. The IMF predicts that global growth could fall to 3.1% this year, down from 3.4% in 2025.
And Hassett's not the only Trump official who is downplaying the toll that the war is taking on the U.S. economy. Speaking at an event hosted by Semaphore on Tuesday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said, quote, "The conflict will end, prices will come down, and then headline inflation will come down."
Matt, you know, I have this rule. Whatever Scott Bessent says, I assume the exact opposite. But you know what's making me feel better? Schadenfreude. Through MAGA International mourning the loss of Viktor Orban's authoritarian rule in Hungary. The American far right has long admired Orban's strongman rule in Hungary as he crushed the free press and villainized immigrants and LGBT people while the economy suffered and the birth rate, a major MAGA obsession, declined despite massive state investment in the issue. Here's Hungary's then foreign minister telling Tucker Carlson in 2022 why Hungary was so great for conservatives.
"We are conducting a patriotic, Christian-based policy The target of ours is to reach the to fulfill the national interest. We are conservative, and in the meantime, we are successful.
Apparently not. And Vice President J.D. Vance even traveled to Hungary last week to boost Orbán's odds. But he failed miserably.
And MAGA may have had a much bigger stake in this than we even knew before Vance's trip. In a speech on Monday, Hungary's newly elected leader, Peter Magyar, said that Hungary will no longer fund the Hungarian branch of the Conservative Political Action Conference, better known as CPAC, but, you know, most people these days might know it just as the crazy right-wing conference where Elon Musk swung a chainsaw over his head last year.
To be clear, Magyar said Orbán's government gave them money, but CPAC told Politico that it has never received funding from the Hungarian state. Quote, "Any decisions on the use of government money in Hungary will have zero impact on our organization, as it has never received any of these funds." But CPAC definitely did take their tour to Budapest for several years, highlighting such stars as one of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro's sons and Maryland Republican Congressman Andy Harris and a far-right Hungarian journalist who is super racist. It's not the first time the right has fallen in love with a right-wing government, Matt, but Hungary? The country with major ties to China and Russia? Really? But, Matt, now the relationship makes more sense because it looks like the draw wasn't just ideology, it was also money.
Yeah. Hungary's politics are pretty intense, and America's are too, but America's these days are just downright strange. Take, for example, the case of Greg Phillips. He's the Federal Emergency Management Agency official in charge of disaster response. He's also apparently totally delusional. You might be familiar with him after CNN uncovered a podcast from last year in which he said that he teleported to Waffle House in Georgia dozens of miles away. Here's a clip from that podcast.
It's scary in a way. I mean, you don't really know, okay, is this evil? Is this good? What is this? Is, you know, what do I do with this? How do I deal with it? I was on the phone. Oh my God, what's happening?
CNN got Trump on the phone to talk about that on Thursday, and he did not seem sold on the possibilities of teleportation.
That's an amazing sentence. And no, he did not. Quote, "Was he kidding?" Trump asked CNN when told about Phillips' claim. He added, quote, "It just sounds a little strange, but I know nothing about teleporting or him, but I'll find out about it right now." One of my favorite Trump things is that if you do something he doesn't like, he will completely Mariah Carey you. He doesn't know him. He has no idea who he is. Who is this guy anyway? And hilariously, the New York Times did the legwork and went to the Waffle House where this man claimed to have teleported to. And no employees or regulars at that location remember anyone teleporting there. Though, stumbling into Waffle House after a long night does feel a lot like teleportation.
That is objectively true. But Phillips has said some even weirder things on podcasts, according to CNN. Do you want to hear them, Jane?
I don't, but I do. So,
all
go
right.
Ahead.
Yeah, well, here we go. He claimed that God sat on his bed and diagnosed him with cancer. He said that he's on earth to do God's work, but that he's, quote, actually dead. And he said that his deceased girlfriend lifted his car off the road to help him avoid a car crash. How sweet, I guess.
Well, I sure hope that when a natural disaster hits, this guy can find a way to teleport to my house. Or, actually, I would really prefer someone more qualified than him. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
And that's the news. Before we go, if your timeline turned into a dusty live stream of influencers in the desert this weekend, you're not alone. On this week's Keep It, Louis Vertel is joined by guest co-host Ivy Wolk to break down all the chaos, from Coachella to the long-awaited return of Euphoria. Plus, actor Paul Walter Hauser stops by to talk about his latest projects, career curveballs, and everything in between. New episodes of Keep It drop every Wednesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. That's all for today. If you like the show, make sure you subscribe, leave a review, celebrate winners, not losers, and tell your friends to listen. And if you're into reading, I'm not just about Virginia Democratic Governor Abigail Spanberger finally ending tax exemptions for organizations that celebrate and honor the Confederacy, like me. War Today is also a nightly newsletter. Check it out and subscribe at crooked.com/subscribe. I'm Jane Costin. And maybe you should have thought about the tax implications of fomenting a rebellion against the Union to support the institution of slavery. What a Day is a production of Crooked Media. It's recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Our associate producer is Emily Four. Our producer is Caitlin Plummer. Our video editor is Joseph Dutra. Our video producer is Johanna Case. We had production help today from Greg Walters, Matt Berg, and Ethan Oberman. Our senior producer is Erica Morrison, and our senior vice president of news and politics is Adrian Hill. Our theme music is by Kyle Murdoch and Jordan Cantor. We had help today from the Associated Press. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.